Good morning. I hope you came hungry for the Word of God because I have an extra helping for you today. Today marks our third lesson on the rapture. In our first two lessons, we looked at what the dispensational premillennialists teach, such as Hal Lindsey and Billy Graham. I examined their two major proof texts where they try to say that the rapture exists. But as we examined those verses, we discovered that their particular doctrine, their view, does not exist within those passages. We also pointed out the fact that the word rapture cannot be found anywhere within the Bible. In our Sunday evening lesson, we also examined what they teach about the kingdom. They believe that Jesus was to come to the earth in the first century and that he was to establish a physical kingdom. But because the Jews rejected him, he had to end up leaving us just with the church. And so they would say that the church and the kingdom are two different things. And they believe that sometime in the near future, that Jesus is going to come back to the earth and finally establish his earthly kingdom. But I show from Scripture that the Bible teaches very clearly that the kingdom was to be spiritual in nature, and that the church and the kingdom go hand in hand. And both of them began on the day of Pentecost. In fact, we've shown several scriptures that show that the Christians that day were in the kingdom right then, just as we today are in that same kingdom. So my goal for today is to examine Matthew chapter 24 and to do an overview of Matthew chapter 25. Matthew chapter 24 is a chapter that has been misunderstood by many. And those who teach the rapture theory believe that there are signs by which we can know when Jesus is about to return. And of course, they believe that those signs are happening right now and that Jesus will come very soon within our generation. Now before we begin looking at Matthew 24 itself, I want to lay down some basic guidelines that we should all follow in order to figure out any given chapter within the Bible. One of the most important things you must do is to look at the context so you can know what's going on. This means that you need to look at the previous chapter, as it may contain great insight on what's going on. Also, it's very important to examine any other verses or parallel accounts of the content of the chapter you are examining. Finally, whenever you're examining a more difficult chapter, try and find a verse within that chapter that will help unlock it and make it easy for you to understand. I will be using this basic guideline to show you what Matthew 24 really teaches. So the first thing we need to do is we need to find out what is going on in Matthew chapter 23. In this chapter, Jesus is in Jerusalem at the temple, and he begins to speak to his disciples and telling them about the Pharisees and the scribes. And he began to talk about the many sins that they have in their lives. And he pronounces all these woes upon them. But now let's begin looking at the end of this chapter and see what Jesus says, starting in verse number 32. It says, "Fill up then the measure of your father's guilt, serpents, brood of vipers. How can you escape the condemnation of hell? Therefore, indeed, I send you prophets, wise men, and scribes. Some of them will kill you and crucify, and some of them you will scourge in your synagogues and persecute from city to city, that on you may come all the righteous blood shed on the earth, from the blood of the righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar. Assuredly, I say to you, all these things will come upon this generation. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the one who kills the prophets and stone those who are sent to her. How often I wanted to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings. But you were not willing. See, your house is left to you desolate." Jesus is making it clear in these scriptures that the Jews had rejected him and that the blood of the prophets would be on their head. Here Jesus pronounces a judgment upon these Jews, and he tells them that this judgment will come up on their generation. In other words, it's going to happen in their lifetime. He also says that God has left their house desolate. In other words, his presence was no longer there. He was no longer going to protect them. And now the temple is called their house. This judgment that Jesus is talking about here is referring to the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. Now, we can see that this happened some 30 to 40 years after he made this statement. And this goes right in the timeline of what a generation is, because a generation is considered to be 30 to 40 years in length. Now, with this in mind, I want to show you what I believe to be a key verse in Matthew 24 that will help us to understand that entire chapter. Matthew 24 and verse 34 reads, "Assuredly I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place." Now, no matter how you decide to explain Matthew 24, Jesus makes it easy for us to see that all the verses preceding verse 34 were to happen in that generation. Just as we saw at the end of Matthew 23, we can see that those events and those verses were to occur sometime within a 30 to 40 year span. Now, what the premillennialists try to do is to change the meaning of generation in our key verse to simply to denote the Jewish race. In other words, they have Jesus saying that the Jewish race will not pass away until all these things take place. This is how they justify stretching out the time span of when all these things are to occur. But even they will admit that the word generation is very rarely used to mean race. Instead, the word generation is almost always defined as the sum total of those born at the same time, expanded to include all those living at a given time. In fact, out of the 37 times this word is used in the New Testament, I could not find one instance where it is ever used to refer to a race. Instead, it is always talking about this time span. Let me give you just one example of what I'm talking about. In Matthew 1 and verse number 17, notice what it says. "So all the generations from Abraham to David are 14 generations." It's very obvious that generation here is talking about a time span and not a race, because this verse wouldn't make any sense if you substituted the word generation with the word race. Please keep this in mind as we begin to examine Matthew 24 and note that all those things preceding verse 34 had to happen in the lifetime of those living in that day. My goal today is to show you that Matthew 24 is talking about two different events. Verses 1 through 34 are talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, and verses 36 through 51 are talking about Jesus' second coming when the end of the world will occur. Let us begin now by looking at Matthew 24, starting in verse 1. "Then Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came up to show him the buildings of the temple. And Jesus said to them, 'Do you not see all these things? Assuredly I say to you, not one stone shall be left here upon another that shall not be thrown down.'" Now we learn from verse 3 that Jesus had departed from the temple and that he went up to the Mount of Olives opposite of the temple. Now the reason why it got this name, Mount of Olives, is because it had so many olive trees on it. This was a mountain that had great vantage point of looking over the wall of Jerusalem and to be able to look at the temple. Now, I want to point out that these events that take place in this chapter are also recorded in Mark chapter 13 and Luke chapter 21. Each of these accounts have additional information that the others don't, so I will be referring to these accounts to give us a complete picture of what's going on here. We learn that Jesus' disciples began to show Jesus the marvelous buildings of the temple of Jerusalem and how beautiful they were. But then Jesus tells them something that just really shocked them to the core. But he said, "Look, you see all these beautiful things, the temple? Not one stone is going to be left upon another. It's all going to be destroyed." Now, this was truly an amazing statement that Jesus makes here, because at this time, they were still building upon these buildings within Jerusalem. In fact, they didn't even finish until 64 A.D. Also, at this time, they were at a time of peace. And so, again, this was an amazing statement that Jesus makes here. But this is exactly what Jesus was talking about in Matthew chapter 23 whenever he said that all the blood of the prophets would be upon that generation. Of course, this really got his disciples very interested, and they wanted to ask Jesus some questions. And they wanted to know about what in the world he was talking about here. And so what we find is in all three accounts we see some questions asked. And I want to show you what all three accounts record of the questions that they do ask Jesus at that time. In Matthew's account, we see three questions. It says in Matthew 24 and verse 3, "Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?" Luke's account shows us two questions. Luke 21 and verse 7 says, "So they asked him, saying, 'Teacher, but when will these things be, And what sign will there be when these things are about to take place? Mark's account also shows two questions. Mark 13 and verse 4. Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign when all these things will be fulfilled? This is why it's very important for us to look at all parallel accounts in the gospel. Because when we look at just one or two, we don't get the complete picture. However, when we look at all of them together, then we can know that we've got all the information. For example, in both Luke and Mark's account, we only see recorded for us two questions, and they only deal with the destruction of Jerusalem. They want to know, when will the destruction of Jerusalem happen, and what will be the signs that show that it's going to happen? But then we learn in Matthew chapter 24 that they also want to know, what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age? Now, another end-time view, which we are not studying today, would suggest this question also refers to the destruction of Jerusalem as well. However, that cannot be the case, but the question about his coming is linked with the question about the end of the age, which tells me that this question they are asking about his second coming, because the word age or world in the King James Version shows that they were wanting to know what are the signs of the end of the world. Now, the reason why I say this is because every time this word is used in the New Testament, it either refers to the world itself or to time. Now, the reason I point this out is because some try to say that this is referring to the end of the Jewish age or nation instead of the end of the world. But again, as far as I've been able to see, every single time this phrase, end of the world or end of the age, it always refers to time or it refers to the world itself. So basically, we have two topics that they are asking about. When would the destruction of Jerusalem occur, and what would be the signs? When will Jesus come and bring about the end of the world, and what would be the signs of that? Now, some have suggested that maybe his disciples thought that the destruction of Jerusalem and the end of the world would occur at the same time. And that's certainly plausible, because throughout Jesus' ministry, his disciples had been confused on many matters. For instance, Jesus taught them multiple times about his death and how he had to be raised from the dead. Yet you read in John 20 in verse number 9, after Jesus had already been put to death, that the disciples still did not understand the scriptures that he must be raised again. Also in Matthew chapter 13, full of different parables, Jesus teaches in this chapter about the condition of a person's heart, the importance and strength of God's kingdom, and he even gave two different parables about the end of the world or the end of the age, which has to do with the separating of the fish and the separating of the tares and wheat. And in both of these, he talks about it being at the end of the world or being at the end of the age. And then at the end of all these things, in verse 51, Jesus asked them the question, do you understand what I'm talking about? And his disciples said, yes, we understand. However, I question what they did understand. Because as you go into Acts chapter 1 and verse number 6, just before Jesus was about to ascend into heaven, the disciples started asking about when the kingdom would be restored back to the children of Israel. Again, they were thinking of a carnal kingdom, a physical one. They had not understood yet that the kingdom was of a spiritual nature. And so it is certainly plausible that they thought maybe these events of the destruction of Jerusalem would happen at the same time of the end of time. But as far as I can tell, it doesn't really matter what they thought or if they were confused. What's important is the fact that Jesus is going to settle any confusion, because in chapter 24, he's going to show that the destruction of Jerusalem and the signs that show what it's going to be are one event, and that the end of the world is a different event that's going to happen at a different time. Now in verses 4 through 14, Jesus warns his disciples not to be fooled by false signs that they would experience before the destruction of Jerusalem would occur. Look at verse number 4. And Jesus answered and said to them, take heed that no one deceive you, for many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and will deceive many. Here Jesus says that there will be many people who come in his name trying to say that they are the Messiah. The Bible records for us in Acts 5 and verse 35 through 37 that some men had claimed to be something great and led some people away to slaughter. Also, historians like Josephus talk about how many false messiahs were stepping up during those days. Now look at verse 6. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, But the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines, pestilence, and earthquakes in various places. All these are the beginning of sorrows. Again, all these things or signs are going to take place before the destruction of Jerusalem. And please note that these are not signs that they can look at and say, okay, the destruction of Jerusalem is here. No, these are just general things that were going to be happening, and they were not supposed to be fooled by these things. You also notice the text says that these things that are happening are the beginning of sorrows. So those who teach the rapture view try to say that these are signs that show that the rapture is about to occur. But again, this is simply not the case, because it is the beginning of sorrows, and it is not showing that something is just about to occur. Now think about this for just a minute. If Jesus was going to give us some sort of signs that we could look at to know that he was going to be coming back, don't you think he would give us some signs that weren't as vague as these ones that we just read? After all, when you go back in history and look at it, you can see that all of these signs are repeated over and over again. It would make it almost impossible to know whenever the end of time would be. And so it makes absolutely no sense that these signs are anything that alludes to when Jesus will come back again. And to show that these signs were even going on between the time of 30 AD and 70 AD, let me give you a few examples. Vincent notes that between this prophecy by Jesus in 30 AD and the destruction of Jerusalem, there was an earthquake in Crete in 46 to 47 AD, at Rome in 51 AD, at Apamea, Phrygia in 60 AD, and at Campania in 41 to 54 AD. He also notes four famines during the reign of Claudius in 41 to 54 AD. One of these famines are taught within the book of Acts, Acts 11 and verse 28. Also, an early writer named Tacitus describes the hurricanes and storms in Campania in AD 65. There are several more events that I could list, but this is sufficient enough to show that these type of things were happening before the destruction of Jerusalem, just as Jesus said they would be. Now look at verse number 9. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. Again, the book of Acts clearly reveals the fulfillment of this prediction. The apostles were beaten and put into prison in Acts 4, chapter 5. Stephen was stoned to death in Acts 6 and chapter 7. There was a great persecution against the church in Acts 8 and chapter 9. And James was beheaded in Acts chapter 12, just to name a few. Of course, history also points out the great persecution that was going on with Christians during that time. Now, Mark adds this to his account in Mark 13 and verse number 11. It says, "But when they arrest you and deliver you up, do not worry beforehand or premeditate what you will speak, but whatever is given you in that hour, speak that, for it is not of you who speak, but the Holy Spirit." This certainly limits these events that were going on, happening in the first century, because when they were arrested, the Holy Spirit would give them the word by which they could speak. Now, this would be a study all by itself, but we know that 1 Corinthians 13 and Ephesians 4 and other passages make it clear that the miraculous speaking of tongues and miracles themselves were limited to the first century, because only the apostles had the ability to lay their hands on people and allow them to have miraculous gifts. And the apostles have been dead for a very, very long time. And so again, this gives us an instance showing that this is talking about a local event, because even though there are some that claim today that they are speaking in tongues or that they have miracles, there is not one documented case that I have ever seen where like a withered arm has become whole, or any documented case where a real miracle is taking place. And so again, we can see this is limited to the first century. Now look at Matthew 24 and verse 10. "And then many will be offended, will betray one another, and will hate one another. Then many false prophets will rise up and deceive many. And because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold, but he who endures to the end shall be saved." Again, these are all things that happened before the destruction of Jerusalem. And we can see these events taking place in Scripture, where people started losing their love for God and abandoning people. You can see this in passages such as 2 Timothy 2 and verse 15, and chapter 4 verses 10 and verses 16. We also have this recorded for us in history. Fact is, the Roman historian records that several Christians at first were apprehended, and then by their discovery, a multitude of others were convicted and cruelly put to death with derision and insult. What he's saying there is once they found some Christians, they turned on the other Christians. They gave them up and said where they were at, and so many more Christians were killed because of that. Now, when a person gets to verse 13, which says, "But he who endures to the end shall be saved," they might think that that's talking about salvation in heaven. And that's certainly what the Bible teaches in other places. Revelation 2:10, talking about if you remain faithful till the day you die, you will receive a crown of righteousness. However, in context, I do not believe that this is talking about the salvation of the soul, but instead it's talking about salvation of one's life. Luke adds that not one hair of their head would be lost during this time. And since Jesus goes on from this further on into the chapter, talking about how they can escape what's going to happen at the destruction of Jerusalem, this is talking about them being able to save their lives. If they watch the signs, if they make sure and pay attention, they're going to be able to flee and not lose their life. Josephus and others back this up historically, because not one Christian has ever been recorded of losing their life during the destruction in Jerusalem. In fact, many other Christians of that time went to Pella in 70 AD, according to Eusebius. Now look at Matthew 24:14. "And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations, and then the end will come." This is another critical verse, because whatever the end is talking about here, we had to see that first, before the end could come about, the gospel had to be preached to all the nations, to all the world, as a witness. Well, those who teach the rapture theory would say that this has not happened yet. And that's why they're trying to go out into the world and preach the gospel so that the rapture can occur. But I want you to notice what the Bible says in Colossians 1 and verse number 5. "Just because of the hope which is laid up for you in heaven, of which you heard before in the word of truth of the gospel, which has come to you, as it has also in all the world." Also note Colossians 1:23. "If indeed you continue in the faith, grounded and steadfast, and are not moved away from the hope of the gospel which you heard, which was preached to every creature under heaven, of which I, Paul, became a minister." Also Romans 10:18 and Romans 16:26 all show that the gospel had indeed been preached to all the world. The book of Colossians was written around 61-63 AD. The book of Romans was written around 57-58 AD, which clearly shows that the gospel had been preached to all the world before the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. So clearly we can see that the end Jesus is talking about here is the destruction of Jerusalem and not the end of the world. All these things would happen before the destruction of Jerusalem, but now Jesus is going to tell his disciples the real signs, the things they could sink their teeth in and know that the destruction of Jerusalem was about to happen. Notice as we look at verse 15. "Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand." Now the word abomination means detestable things having to do with idolatry. And the word desolation means destruction. We also need to note that Jesus said that Daniel spoke of this event. Now Daniel talks about the abomination of desolation in chapters 9, 11, and 12. In all three of these chapters, this terminology is used to describe the defilement of the temple. But the specific prophecy Jesus is talking about has to do with the 70 weeks of Daniel in chapters 9, verses 24 through 27. Now, I wish I had the time today to look at this prophecy in detail, but I simply do not. But don't worry, because next week we will look at that prophecy closer. But when you read this prophecy in Daniel, I think it's pretty easy to see that Jesus and the destruction of Jerusalem are in that prophecy. And Jesus says that this is the thing that Daniel was speaking of in Matthew 24. Now, Luke version shows exactly what Jesus had in mind of what this abomination of desolation is all about. Notice what Luke 21:20 says. It says, "But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near." That's what the abomination of desolation is. It's the Roman armies coming in and destroying the temple of Jerusalem. Again, I think it's interesting to note that Jesus talks about this at an earlier time. Makes this same prediction in Luke 19 in verse 41. It says, "Now as he drew near, he saw the city and wept over it, saying, If you had known, even you, especially in this your day, the things that make for your peace, but now they are hidden from your eyes. For days will come upon you when your enemies will build an embankment around you, surround you, and close you in on every side, and level you and your children within you to the ground. And they will not leave in you one stone upon another, because you did not know the time of your visitation." So without a doubt, the abomination of desolation was the Roman army led by Titus, who did this very thing in 70 AD, which led to the destruction of Jerusalem. And they did not leave one stone on top of another. In fact, that's backed up by archaeology. Even some of the Jews of that day understood that the Roman army coming upon Jerusalem was prophesied by Daniel. I want you to look at what Josephus says. If you don't know who Josephus is, he was an eyewitness of those events. And he's recorded it for us. Notice what he says. He says, "In the very same manner, Daniel also wrote concerning the Roman government and that our country should be made desolate by them." Here's a Jew that understood that Daniel's prophecy was being fulfilled at the destruction of Jerusalem. Also, note what he says. "And now the Romans upon the flight of the seditious into the city and upon the burning of the holy house itself and of all the buildings lying around about it brought their incense to the temple and set them over against its eastern gate, and there did offer sacrifices to them, and there did they make Titus imperator." And so we see that the Roman army came in, destroyed Jerusalem, and they even offered up false sacrifices to idols right there in the temple area. So it should be easy for everyone to see that Jesus is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem and not some future event that is supposed to take place in our lifetime. The next verses that you're going to see after this all build upon this. They all show that this is talking about a local event, talking about Jerusalem itself. Look at verse 15. "Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee for the mountains. Let him who is on the housetop not go down to take anything out of the house. And let him who is in the field not go back to get his clothes." Jesus is saying, when the army is on its way surrounding Jerusalem, don't waste any time. Get out of there. He tells them to flee to the mountains. Now think about this for a minute. If this was talking about the end of time, as the premillennialists want you to believe, and during this time there's supposed to be all these nuclear weapons and this modern-day warfare going on, would you really want to go to the mountains? Does that make a lot of sense? Well, it doesn't to me. Verse 17 shows us that he's talking about those living in Jerusalem. Because back then, the houses within the city were side by side. And all of them had flat roofs. And this was a common place people hung out. They slept up there. They prayed up there. They even had social events up there. And so it was very common for them to be on their rooftops. This is why he says, don't come down from your rooftops and get something out of your house. One writer said that all the housetops linked together kind of made a roadway, because a person could go from one housetop to the other and make their way out of Jerusalem. Also, we've seen recorded here that those who were out in the field were not to go back to get their clothes or anything else. They were to flee when that army started coming. Again, this goes hand in hand with what Jesus is talking about here. Now look at verse 19. "But woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days. And pray that your flight may not be in the winter or on the Sabbath." Again, this gives us more proof that Jesus is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. It would be very difficult for those who were nursing to get out in time, to take those babies along with them. It would also be a difficult time to travel during that time if it was winter time. Now you think about that. You apply that to us today. How difficult is it for us to travel during the winter? It's not hard at all. We get in our cars, turn on the heater, and we can be comfortable. And it might be difficult for someone nursing to get their baby all loaded up. But again, that wouldn't be that difficult for us today. Again, this is talking about these first century Jews, these first century Christians during this time. And the thing that really shows it to be linked to the city of Jerusalem is the fact that Jesus said, pray that it doesn't happen on the Sabbath. Now think about that. The Sabbath has absolutely nothing to do with Christians today. The Sabbath was something that was given to the children of Israel, something that they were to observe. And so what we learn is in Nehemiah 13:19, starting then, on the Sabbath, they would close the gates of the city because they didn't want people walking too far. And so from that point forward, on the Sabbath, the gates were closed. And if the gates were closed, that would make it almost impossible for people to escape if the Roman army came at that time. Again, that shows without a doubt that this is talking about a local event. It's talking about Jerusalem itself, because that's the only way that would make sense that you'd be concerned that it happened upon the Sabbath day. Now look at Matthew 24, verse 21. For then there will be great tribulation, such as not been since the beginning of the world until this time, nor ever shall be. And unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. Now to go along with this verse, I want to give you a little bit of history. Starting in 66 A.D., the Jews and the Romans began to fight one another. Most believe the Zealots were the instigators of this struggle. Josephus records for us in his Book of Wars, in Book 2, Chapter 19, tells us how the Roman general, Cestius, surrounded Jerusalem in 66 A.D., had his chance to take them down right then. But for no apparent reason, he left the siege at Jerusalem. This certainly would have been a wake-up call for the Christians of that day, as they remembered what Jesus had told them about the abomination of desolation. But from 66 A.D. all the way to 70 A.D., we see that the Romans and the Jews were fighting off and on again. And at the same time, there was a great civil war that began to develop amongst the Jews. I recommend that you look at the book of Josephus and look how it records about all those events, those great tribulations that were going on during this whole time. It led up to whenever Titus finally came in 70 A.D. and really surrounded Jerusalem and destroyed it in 70 A.D. Now, some of the things that were going on during this time, whenever Titus came in with his army, they locked the place down. People were trapped inside. And it was said that they had enough food to last for several years. But somehow their food caught on fire and a great famine broke out within the walls of Jerusalem. And because there was a great civil war going on, many dead bodies started piling up within the temple area, which was an abomination of itself. And we also have a very horrible thing that happened in the city of Jerusalem, very similar to 2 Kings 6, verses 24 through 30. A woman got so hungry that she killed her only baby, and she ate it. The Romans also are recorded of crucifying around 500 Jews a day. After all was said and done, 1,100,000 Jews were reported killed, and 97,000 were captured. Now, this is an ugly scene, but this was exactly what Jesus said would happen, how there would be this great tribulation. Now, it is also interesting to note that not one Christian is recorded as being put to death by the Romans during this siege in 70 A.D. In fact, earlier writers said that many of the Christians fled from Jerusalem and made their way to the place called Pella. Again, this tells us that the Christians, they understood the signs. They understood what the abomination of desolation was, that it was this Roman army. And so as soon as they saw them gathering, they fled and they ran. And not one of them lost their life. Josephus also tells us whenever the Roman army came in to destroy the temple, at this time, it was a time of the Passover. And so Jews were gathered from all around, and there was just tons of people within the city at that time. Josephus also tells us that that temple was destroyed on the same day and the same month as Solomon's temple was earlier in history. One more interesting point is that when the temple caught on fire, the gold ran down through the stones, and so it was all melted between them. And so the soldiers, not wanting to leave any of this precious metal behind, tore down every stone to get after that gold. Again, here we see where history and the Bible are in perfect harmony. Now look at Matthew 24 and verse 23. So then if anyone says to you, look, here is the Christ, or there, do not believe it. For false Christ and false prophets will rise and show great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect. See, I have told you beforehand. Therefore, if they say to you, look, he is in the desert, do not go out. Or look, he is in the inner rooms, do not believe it. For as the lightning comes from the east and flashes to the west, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. Here Jesus is re-emphasizing his point from earlier. Don't be fooled by false Christ or false prophets, because whenever I come, it's going to be like the lightning going from the east to the west. In other words, everyone's going to know it when Jesus comes back again. It's going to be visible, and everybody is going to know about it. Look at verse 28. For wherever the carcass is, there the eagles will be gathered together. Now this is a proverb that Jesus is speaking here. I believe the carcass is speaking of the Jewish nation, which was dead immorally and spiritually, just as Jesus told them they were in Matthew chapter 23. Now we all know what birds of prey do. They are attracted to dead carcasses, and they come out and they devour it. Now the word eagle, or vulture in some translations, was used in the Old Testament to describe when a foreign nation would come up on the Jewish nation for punishment. You can see this in Deuteronomy 28 and verse 49, Hosea 8 and verse number 1, and Habakkuk chapter 1 and verse number 8. So this is talking about the Romans, who are representative of the eagle, to devour the Jewish nation by destroying their city in 70 AD. Well, I would love to continue on and make our way all the way through Matthew 24, but I'm going to stop right there. And I hope that you will come back tonight and you will join us as we will begin to looking at verse 29 all the way through the end of chapter 24 and do an overview of chapter 25. We'll begin looking at what is known as apocalyptic language. Many get confused about this, but once you look at the whole counsel of God, you can see what this is describing within these verses. I hope you have learned from this lesson this morning how important it is to take the whole counsel of God to be able to look at a particular chapter. I also hope you have seen that you see that there was two questions asked to Jesus, and he's currently answering the one about the signs that would bring about the destruction of Jerusalem. And we'll be continuing to look at that some more tonight.